This episode is presented by Henry's Wine and Spirit.
Welcome to the Grape Nation, your weekly wine journey. Our guest is Jonelle Fallner.
How'd I do?
We'll talk to Jonelle about the new generation of Psalms. We'll talk about Atomics and more. We'll taste the field blend from the Douro Valley for our weekly wine sip. I'm your host, Sam Ben Ruby. Stay with us for the Grape Nation on the Heritage Radio Network. We bring wine to the people. All right, from Manila to Japan and finally New York City, Jonelle Fallner landed in the Big Apple to pursue his love of wine after a stint in fashion and being swept up by the wine culture in Japan. He worked his way through 1-5 Hospitality and the Nomad before running the wine program at one of the country's hottest restaurants. Jonelle is an advanced Somm, studying for his MS currently. He is a Wine and Spirits Best New Sommelier from 2018, so fresh off of that. And he is the head sommelier at Atomics in New York City. Welcome to the Grape Nation, Jonelle.
Thanks for having me, Sam.
Thanks for coming in. And I want to give people a little context of who you are. So take a few minutes to talk to us about your journey in life and wine that got you to that circuitous route to New York and becoming the head somm at Atomics.
Atomics. Sure. Yeah. So it's a fairly short story, actually. But I was born and raised in Manila. Spent all my life over there. Not a big wine-drinking city yet. Yet is the key word there that I'm hoping to change in the future. But graduated with a degree in business, and then just got really interested in what else was outside, you know, the city that I grew up in, the country I grew up in, and kind of decided to see what was outside. So actually, New York, shortly after college, for 6 weeks, sort of more in a vacation style format, was my first foray into just seeing what was out there. Got inspired by that, and then landed in Japan for a year and a half doing fashion and retail, which was...
How do you just land in Japan?
That's true.
You know, it's not around.
That's true.
What pushed you towards that?
Yeah, well, we got scouted out during our senior year of college. So a big company, Fast Retailing, was sort of attracting global recruits for like a global program that they were starting off. And so that was really exciting because they were picking only just a couple of people from each country. So I thought that was a worthy challenge and, you know, something fun to do outside of sort of the school confines.
Right.
And so took a shot at it and got through. And so there was a bit of time, a couple of months before we actually had to start, leading me to New York for, you know, a short stint.
Right.
And just really relaxing and taking in the city for the first time, you know, as a 20-year-old, which was
what year was this?
This was back in 2011.
Okay.
Yeah. So that was a really magical time. It was summer, you know, not like the winter we're having now where it's, you know, everybody's covered up. It was the complete opposite. And just, you know, being fresh out of college straight in New York City was probably one of the best things.
Walk around everywhere.
Yeah. I took over my uncle's apartment in Stuytown. And that was like the best thing ever. You could just walk around everywhere. I'm like, oh my gosh, like what is this city all about? So promptly fell in love with New York, but then had to ship out after to take on this new challenge in Japan. So did that. Another wonderful experience. Learned so much over there, but really fell in love with food over there. Just because every single, you know, street corner you turn, there's something, you know, happening. Awesome food that's being cooked, whether it's in, you know, a proper restaurant or just like a neighborhood joint. So just kind of fell in love with that there. And of course, the wine culture over there, I wasn't really paying attention, but I was surely drinking it with friends, peers, and, you know, the bosses as well.
Right.
And just kind of had that in mind. That when it was time to move out of Japan, I wanted to move back to New York because I really hadn't gotten enough of it yet at that point in time.
Where's family at this point? Are they influencing you to go, stay, do what you want?
A little bit of both. Family is all back in Manila. I do have a sister who's in Chicago. But they, just because of the culture, I guess the wine culture in Manila is not really there yet. They don't really know what the hell I'm doing over here. You know, what is this wine thing that you're doing?
What do they think you're doing?
They probably think I'm drinking a lot, which is not necessarily false, but, you know, there's a whole world out there, a whole culture that, you know, is very strong here in New York more than other cities, I suppose.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that part, especially going home and then, you know, bringing bottles over there to drink, you know, with food, with family at the dinner table, I think that's instantly like something anybody and everybody can relate to, you know, including my family.
All right. So you decide to come to New York. And what's the path to where you are now?
Yeah.
Tell me what you did.
Yeah, the original path was actually to continue on the corporate route and stay with fashion and retailing because because that was already what I was doing. And but I just was curious about this whole other industry that was here, specifically wine, and just sort of took a leap into it at Amali, a small restaurant on the Upper East Side on 60th and Lex. And at that time, I wasn't committed in any way. But tried out the restaurant industry sort of in my spare time while looking for, quote unquote, a real job in the corporate sector, and just promptly like fell into that rabbit hole with, you know, some Greek wine, you know, some fresh Assyrtiko, some Sino Mavros. Those were some of the first wines I ever tasted. It wasn't like, you know, Chardonnay or Sauvignon Blanc.
Right.
I kind of learned about those a little
good
later.
Good stuff, though, and hot now.
Yeah, really, really good stuff.
Yeah.
So got my first taste there, and then, you know, just really pursued it seriously, you know, got involved with the James Beard Foundation with a few study grants, and then the International Culinary Center in Soho, which has this like really amazing sommelier program run by Master Soms, specifically Scott Carney,
right,
who is to this day, you know, one of my best mentors. So that year, which is 2013, was just such a roller coaster ride because I was working, and then I was also pursuing an internship with Josh Green at Wine and Spirits magazine, and that was such a great sort of a, you know, jumping off the deep end, you know, and from not tasting a lot to tasting.
You got to taste while you were up there?
I did. I really did.
They taste a lot of wine then.
Yeah, I helped, you know, catalog wines and also set up the tastings that they do every day.
Perfect for you at that point, right?
Yeah, I mean, you go from tasting maybe one of a certain grape to tasting 40 in a flight, and that was just education that, you know, I didn't know I needed, but is so much, you know, it's so invaluable.
Yeah.
When I look back at it now.
So you move from Amali.
Yes.
It was time.
So
you got your sea legs. It's like, I need to do more.
Well, at that point I had just graduated the course at the ICC, passed my intro and certified on the same day. And I remember Roger DeGorn, who's another, you know, old school, just legend in MS. He was the one who gave me my first SOM job, you know, straight out of class. I was so flabbergasted. I'm like, I have no experience in that. And yet here you are, you know, having just seen me do a mock exam, like, you know, thinking I would be, you know, good enough to hire as a SOM at a restaurant. And so just took that leap with him and with then. So leaving Amali then and then joining him with a 1-5 hospitality at a few places in Union Square.
Right. And how long were you there?
I was there for about a year and a half.
What type of stuff were you doing? I mean, were you getting into service and inventory and
the whole shebang? It was great. I was the only wine person. I was only sommeliering the building there too.
Okay.
So it was three.
It all fell on you.
It all fell on me, but I guess I had, you know, the energy then, which I still do now, but I was running the Fourth American Brasserie, which doesn't exist anymore. We helped open up Boutique and Brazilian restaurant in the same space. And then there was a Scotch lounge on the other side of the building. So it really fell into, you know, wine, spirits, beer, the whole thing, because literally there was nobody else in the building who had to know or who was really teaching me, apart from Roger. But of course, he was at Tocqueville physically,
right?
For the most part then. So we would definitely communicate. He would see me daily. But apart from actual, you know, service, you know, being there, I had that responsibility, which was, you know, really lucky to have had right out of the gate.
You felt good about that?
I felt good.
I mean, as much as you yearn for some direction and oversight, it's nice not to be bugged every other minute. And Roger was good that way?
Yeah, he was really good. He was the perfect amount of teaching, and also like go and make your own mistakes.
Right.
You know, and then let me know about it.
That's how
you
learn.
And then have a good laugh about it.
All right, so at some point you decide time to leave there.
Yes, after a year and a half, one of my other, actually she was my classmate, Sarah Plath, at the ICC. She's now the head som at the Nomad in New York. We reconnected, and then I was, you know, as you do, having a drink in the library at the Nomad one afternoon with guests who were visiting from out of town.
Bar.
And she goes like, oh my gosh, I haven't seen you in so long. You need to meet Thomas. And there I am, you know, halfway through a bottle of wine. I'm like, now is not a good time to meet.
Maybe it was.
Meet somebody, yeah. But, you know, that spawned into, you know, us talking, and then, you know, what eventually led to me, you know, pursuing the Nomad. And
how long after that meeting at the library did
you? I'd say about a month after.
Okay.
Yeah. It was probably a month and a half in total, but conversations kind of started immediately, you know, just to come and check us out, and then became a bit more serious.
They took a liking to you and hoped it would come to. So they hire you. So that's a different level.
Yeah.
I mean, that's Daniel Hum and Will Gordera. That's the whole, and Thomas. So you get there and, you know, what happens? Is it more structured? Is it more intense?
Yes. Not? It was definitely more structured and intense in all the right ways. It's just a team that has so many talented people. And, you know, it's a hotel as well. So it's open,
right. You
know, every single day, morning, morning, lunch, and dinner. So,
how big is the team?
The wine team over there when I had joined was seven sommeliers plus Thomas. So there are eight people on the wine team. But that said, you know, it was a team that actually needed that many people to function the way it did. It was amazing.
Right. So you do that for about, what, 3 years?
Yeah, just a little under 3 years.
Very cool. And you leave what year?
2018, at the end of February.
So we're talking going into a year.
Going into a year almost.
So you leave there and you go to Atomics.
I do,
but tell me quickly how that comes about.
Yes. So this goes back a few years before then because I'd been eating at Attaboy since the very beginning. I'd met Elia before Attaboy.
So Attaboy is the same chef owner as Atomics.
Yes.
So just to set up the connection for the listeners.
Yeah, so Attaboy and Atomics are restaurants by Chef JP Park and Elia Park.
Right.
And I met Elia before this had ever happened when she was still at Narita. So we just kind of forged that friendship. And then when Attaboy was opening up, she had invited me. So I was there for, you know, the first day of friends and family and just never left, you know, told a lot of people, you got to go to this place. It's so good. And promptly went there, you know, myself, probably the only restaurant I've actually dined at, you know, significantly in double digits,
right?
Which is pretty awesome.
Yeah.
So when this opportunity came about in late 2017, we had started talking about it, you know, at the tail end about December. You know, we had gone to the space, which was a construction site, and just kind of talked about it. I was like, you know, I wouldn't have left the team for anything else because the Nomad is...
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, that's top of the game.
Yeah.
And it was best people, best place.
Correct.
Great op.
Yeah. And really a family,
but
too.
But there's always something worth...
Yeah. And something worth checking out. And, you know, and they were pushing so hard. And I know how much of a talent he is in the kitchen with the food he's putting out. I mean, I've been eating his food for the last two years. I'm like, of course. So we essentially, you know, decided on it. I decided on it. And then he just kind of went for it, which is really awesome.
Did you get any BS or pushback at Nomad, or they were...
No,
happy.
I mean, they were happy. They were definitely...
They didn't want to see you go, but
they
saw it as a legit op, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's always risk with the openings, but they couldn't have been more supportive, especially Thomas.
Right. And I think if you look back and it's not that long, it's, you know, you did the right thing for yourself. All right, we're going to talk a little later about the restaurant and the wine list, but I want to talk to you about a bunch of other things.
Cool.
So I look at you, and I don't think I'm wrong. I look at you as sort of a new age of sommeliers. You know, Thomas Pastuchak, who's no old guy, but he's older than you.
Yeah,
you know, you're younger. You were schooled under longer running somms, you know, like a Thomas and that. You know, there's a lot different eating opportunities, non-traditional foods and all that. So do you see a change in the industry? I mean, do you see yourself as sort of different? Do you look at differently, or you apply old to new, new to new? Tell me your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I mean, I can't necessarily qualify myself as part of the new guard, if I even, you know, apply to that in any way. But I guess I kind of joined sort of the sommelier community in that sort of 2014 kind of push, and that was when, you know, the Somm documentary was really hot. People were really getting into it. Maybe not necessarily to get into the industry, but because wine and being a sommelier was beginning to be cool, quote unquote, which was, you know, not necessarily different from how I thought about it, but definitely sort of a different impetus for me to join then than that. So yeah, I think there's definitely been a big change. I think, you know, there are always pros and cons, but I think, you know, sommeliers now, you know, having learned from, you know, people like Scott Carney and Roger DeGorn, who have been in the industry for so long, as well. I think I bring that, you know, with me, as far as service goes, and the formality of that in some ways, but also
the tenants and, you know, all the basics are there.
But then, yeah, I think sommeliers now are just easy to talk to, or at least very much more apparently so than the classic sort of snooty, snobby.
All right, so let's talk about
sommelier,
that. So let's take that to the next step. Let's talk about how you define what the role of a sommelier is, and really through your own lens. I mean, how do you do it? How do you think it should be done? I mean, you're in a very small, intimate restaurant.
Yeah.
You know, not cheap, definitely worth the money. How do you define, you know, what a sommelier is?
Yeah, so I define a sommelier as being that friendly, knowledgeable person who can, without any pressure, guide you through what could potentially be a really sort of a intimidating document, if you will, that is sort of in between you and the rest of your evening.
Right.
So I think that's really what the role of a sommelier is. You know, it's not just, you know, pointing to a bottle of wine on a wine list, but really sort of sussing out what the person in front of you really wants to drink and how that's going to add to, you know, the final thing at the dinner table.
Right. So we agree that not recently, but many years past, it was kind of a stuck up, intimidating thing. It's less of that. There are still people like that.
Yeah.
But you're there for people. But, you know, what about the guy who comes in and is still intimidated? You pick up on that and try to, you know,
absolutely.
Is that easy to spot?
It is. I think you know, it really is.
There's two things. There's the guy who's just a deer in the headlights and wants to order the right thing. And then I think there's the guy who thinks he knows everything and wants to impress his friends or his girlfriend or whatever.
Yes.
And doesn't know what the hell he's doing.
Yes.
You know, and pushes you aside. I mean, how do you handle that stuff?
Yeah. I mean, I think just being a hospitality professional, you just have to, you know, kind of take different personalities often at the same time, especially at Atomix where service happens, everybody gets seated at the same time and kind of be flexible.
It's a time seating.
It is.
Right.
Yeah. So you have to be flexible and in some ways just know how to interact with different guests and kind of, you know, kind of know what they want and need before they even say it or with the little information that they give you. And I think that's also part of the challenge and the fun of being a sommelier is because it's a little higher stakes. You know, people are spending, you know, a good amount of money on a bottle of wine, whether it's a $50 bottle or something greater. And so kind of speaking with people and kind of getting that information, which sometimes they're not so easy to...
I was going to ask, do most people reveal or do you have to pull it out of them? Or
yeah, some people who dine out regularly
know
how to converse and how to, this is what I like to drink, this is how much I want to spend, this is how I feel today.
And that you could match that up.
Yeah,
what's the hard end of that?
You know,
people who I don't know what I like or what had.
Yeah, the thing, the hard part there is like, especially the question like, well, what do you like to drink? I'm like, well,
right.
I know what I like to drink, but you may not necessarily like what I like to drink. And
wine's even a little different than food, I think.
I think so too.
So you have to kind of pull out of them.
Yes, you know, and you try to get creative with this as well. You know, with now, which is kind of crazy for me to see now as well, but people are asking me like, how do you kind of go about doing this at the dinner table for, you know, some colleagues who are starting to learn wine over at Atoboy and Atomix, like how do you get that information out? And just be calm, be friendly, and you ask them the right questions. And
well, you have a good face, you have a good personality. I mean, you're in a very complimentary way, you're not an intimidating guy. I mean, I think people will, you know, connect with you. You know, there's been a lot of changes in restaurants. Restaurants are more intimate. I think your place is like that.
Yes.
I think more tasting counters exist than 5, 10, 15, 20 years ago.
Yeah.
That's different. Casual dining is kind of big. And I think the diversity of foods.
Yes.
You know, it used to be Italian, French, American. You know, now, God knows. I guess that makes it better for you. It makes it more interesting.
Yes.
In that sense.
For sure, especially in the city, I feel like it's all about, you know, trying something new. We're always sort of on the search for, well, something new, but also something that's really good.
Right.
And that is really exciting.
What, so you said everyone sits down together.
Yeah, so it's an interesting...
How many seats are there?
Yeah, so Atomix is tiny. We do two seatings a night, and we have 14 seats.
So it could be seven couples, it could be a few couples and a foursome.
Exactly.
So you have to get started and kind of go around the horn and get the wine service going.
Yes.
We'll talk about it in a second, but you have pairings, plus you have the full wine list. Mm-hmm. How many people do the pairings on an average night, and how many people order a bottle of wine?
Yeah, I'd say about 30% of guests will do the pairing in
the
given night.
So that makes it easy because you predetermine that.
Exactly.
And then the rest?
And the rest are either doing something by the glass or by the bottle.
Right, but not the pairing setup and all that.
Yeah.
All right, let's talk about, I'm curious, because you have an interesting list and you have to curate the list and you have your own interests. Let's talk about wines, winemakers, regions, grapes that are exciting you right now.
Yeah.
I mean, what are you drawn to? What are you drinking? I mean, give me more than a few things.
Yeah. I mean, just I'm just really drawn to, well, I think as a general category, I think white wines are something that I've been focusing on at least for the last year, just because it's a main focus of
the food
and the wine program that I've been trying to cultivate over at Atomix. It just works so well. You can go through the whole meal and, you know, not necessarily have a drop of red, and I don't think you would feel like you left dinner not having enough of something.
Right.
It's a really, so that as a general category has been really interesting for me to dive in. And then you run the gamut.
So you're trying to expand your horizons on whites more than anything.
Exactly.
And any regions or?
Yeah. I mean, the rabbit hole that is Burgundy is still,
you know,
a favorite for me. But then there are others, of course.
But stay with Burgundy for a second.
Sure.
There's your classic Burgundy. Are there any areas that fan out a little that are good values or making good wines?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, some of the best producers, I mean, we're talking humble Bourgogne Blanc here.
Right.
And that can be an amazing value at the dinner table. We're talking about generic, quote-unquote, white Burgundy, Chardonnay, in its most basic accessible form from really wonderful producers. Like, for example, Chantarev is one producer. It's a Chantereves.
Chantarev.
Yeah, so...
Bourguignon? Or
Bourgogne Blanc, for
Bourgogne
example.
Blanc.
Yeah.
Okay.
So their Chardonnay is like just really crystalline, pure, a great example of sort of a smaller producer that is making waves right now in the industry. And then you can branch off from there too. You know, a little bit outside of Burgundy, you go to the Jura or Savoie.
Okay.
And then you'll find other producers that are just making some classic juice that is...
Chards or whites?
Yeah, I mean, there's some Chardonnays there. You can branch out to a grape called Sauvignon.
Right.
From the Jura.
Not Sauvignon or Sauvignon. It's S-A-V-A-G-I-N.
N-I-N.
N-I-N. Yeah. Sauvignon.
Sauvignon. Yeah.
So that's a nice white.
That's a nice white grape producing, you know, a different
styles. Give me a maker or two that's making good Sauvignon.
Yeah. So I'd say Domaine du Pelican, who has roots in Burgundy.
Right.
Is producing.
Isn't that D'Angerville?
Yeah. That's yes. Marquis d'Angerville's right. project.
Okay.
So that's pretty amazing for over there. And then Philippe Bornard is another producer. So
spell B-E-R?
B-O-R. N-A-R-D.
Philippe so Bornard.
Philippe Bornard.
Okay.
Another producer. I guess this one's a little bit more on the sort of rustic side of winemaking and, you know, just really rugged in all the right ways here on the palate.
What get me out of Burgundy and France? Are there other whites? You're staying on the white thing that are, you know, interesting and compelling to you, restaurant, both separate.
Yes. Yeah. Let's jump on to Portugal.
Okay.
Yeah. I did bring a Portuguese white today.
Yeah. We're going to try
it shortly.
Portuguese white for our weekly wine sip. So tell me about what's going on there.
Yeah. So I was able to, this was inspired by a travel through Portugal in 2016 and just tasting through different regions, different wines, and which is so shocked at how delicious the wines were and how well they go with food. You know, you have a plate of bacalao and a glass of white
famous
wine.
There.
Yeah. And
shrimp.
Exactly. And, you know, you have a bit of white wine with just great acidity from grape varieties you've probably, you know, you don't see often, like Rabigatu, for example, Gouveiu,
right.
Viuzinho. Grape varieties that have been grown there for hundreds of years and are indigenous to the country, but, you know, doesn't get that much mainstream love because A, they're hard to pronounce, and they're not well represented,
right.
But then they're just, you know, a source of great.
And Portugal's so well known for their red wines.
Exactly.
I mean, by acreage, a lot of it goes into port, which, you know, is known. Give me a couple of Portuguese white suggestions that you like.
There's another husband and wife producer I love. It's called Casa de Mouraz. So that's Mouraz.
Okay.
They're located in the Douro region.
Okay.
Of Portugal, and they make the grape here is called Encruzado, and it's just a lean, really mildly waxy white grape that I think goes well with food.
Good acidity.
Great acidity, you know, nothing.
What's the waxy? Gives it some richness or just texture?
Just a little bit of texture on the palate. Not too acidic for those who are kind of veering away from that. But think of this as your all around, you know, you could have this at the dinner table every night and not get tired of it.
Give me one more.
Yeah. Apart from that, the Douro Valley, which is, you know, undoubtedly one of the most beautiful places.
I was just there. We were talking about it. It's gorgeous.
Yeah, it's gorgeous.
I mean, the river runs through these hilly vineyards. The wineries are on the mountain. It just goes on and on. It's really.
Yeah.
So tell me some of the whites that are.
Yeah. So mostly you'll see field blends here. So it's going to depend producer to producer. But and we'll taste this later, too. But Luis Seabra is another producer.
That's,
is in the Douro Valley, producing some amazing whites. Another big classic, Nieuport, which is a port house.
He's experimenting, right?
Yeah, he's making some amazing white wines of great pedigree there as well.
Are they accessible or they're hard to get, the Nieuport wines?
I think they're getting more and more accessible. Yeah, especially at least here in New York, they're they're definitely, you'll see them more often.
New York, the bigger cities.
Yeah.
All right, so those are some good recos. I'm going to, you know, everything we talk about, I'll post on our social media. So we could talk about that. Jonell, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're talking to Jonell Fallner. He is the head somm at Atomics in New York City. When he comes back, I have a few more questions for him, and I want to talk about his wine program over there. You're listening to The Grape Nation. We'll be right back.
This episode is presented by Henry's Wine and Spirit, a go-to shop for anyone interested in natural wines and boutique spirits. There's a large selection of everything from orange wines, pet nats, and reds from around the world. Whether visiting the shop in person or online, looking for a gift for a loved one, or that everyday dependable bottle, you're sure to find lots of interesting wines at Henry's. There's free shipping on orders over $300 on the website henrys.nyc and case discounts when you visit the store located in Bushwick. Cheers.
All right, we're back. We're back with my guest, Jonelle Fallner. Jonelle is the head somm at arguably one of the hottest restaurants in New York, Atomics. It's a small Korean, how would you describe it, Jonelle? It's a counter.
Yes, I'd say it's a tasting menu format by Chef JP and Elliot Park, consisting of 10 courses. We do two seatings a night and 14 seats, so we do 28 people.
That's it. Must be easy to get a reservation.
Getting harder and harder.
So physically, it's not your typical setup because you're not table hopping. You're walking around a counter and all of that.
Correct.
All right, so let's talk about the food, the wine. The Times, Pete Wells gave the restaurant 3 stars, which is, you know, 1 star from the top, which is a very rare error. The restaurant received 1 Michelin star out of the shoot, which is a big deal. And it's run by a chef and his wife. All right, so let's talk about the wine list.
Yeah.
The wine list for that restaurant is how big?
So the wine list right now is just under 400 selections, and it's mostly geared towards white wine. So over 50%, about 60% of the list is...
You alluded to it before, but why is it heavy white?
Yeah, because it truly does work well with the food.
Which is very seafood, fish-centric?
Yes, at the moment at least. It could change menu to menu, but for the last 3 menus we've had, it's predominantly been, you know, not necessarily delicate flavors. For sure there are some delicate flavors in there, but flavors that you just don't want to mask by sort of even the lightest reds would sort of just not go well with. But so whites just really elevate, and I think just add a little seasoning to the
and whites there. From where? Where are the?
Yeah.
How would you break it down? Not exactly, but mostly French.
Yeah, I mean, you would see a lot of French, a lot of white Burgundy for sure. Rieslings from all over, from the Finger Lakes in upstate New York to Germany to Austria, and then you'll have sort of a fun mixed bag of different whites as well. And we have a red section too that's a bit on the mixed side of things, where you have Vermentino from Corsica, you have a little bit of Rotgipfler from Austria, sort of grape varieties that don't necessarily fit with any classic category, but I think, you know, belongs at the dinner table.
Two great wine. I mean, Vermentino's a great
exactly
drinking wine for food and all of that. Yeah. So there's a lot of... Korean food has a lot of cured foods and a lot of fermented foods. Not that the menu is consumed with that, but more than other restaurants, you know, there's stuff like that.
Actually, it is consumed by it.
It is?
In a way that there is probably no dish that doesn't have a component that isn't fermented. It's just very intrinsic to Chef JP's cooking, which is so exciting because we have a little spot in the restaurant in the dining room at Atomix where you'll see some of the experiments that, you know, are just biding its time, fermenting in silence, waiting for, you know, the light of day to be used.
It's coming
in
alive.
Menu. Yeah.
Does that make it harder to pair wines? I mean, obviously you settle on whites and certain types, you know, that are good food wines. But isn't that a tough thing to pair with?
Yes and no. I think just because I've been eating his food at Attaboy for a while, that's given me a good insight as to sort of where his flavor, where his palate is. But also, like, fermented foods naturally have just a great amount of acidity. And then if, you know, using that as sort of the hook, it's easy to find wines that just really match well with the other flavors of the food. If you're matching acidity with acidity, it's something that, you know, is a recipe for success, I think.
Right. Yeah. So the food, definitely plays into the wines that you select.
Absolutely.
I mean, and I guess seasonally it'll change, so you have to stay on your toes you know, keep all of that.
Absolutely.
We talked before about the fact that besides the wine list, you curate a pairing.
Yes.
And you said the meal is 10 courses.
Yes.
You pair how many wines?
Yeah.
For that.
So we have, right now we have 7 different wines.
Wow.
To go along with the 10 courses. And it's really is a motley crew of different styles and grape varieties.
Throw out some of the things. You know, we looked at the list. I mean, it goes from California to Sauternes.
Yeah.
Let's talk about some of the things you put on there.
Sure. Probably one of the most exciting ones for me is probably the first wine I pour is... It's a 2009 Chenin Blanc from the Loire Valley, from a Clos de la Meslerie, really tiny estate in Vouvray. And this wine is actually a moyeu, meaning it's sweet. It's not going to be a dry wine, but then there's so much acidity in this wine that you barely taste sort of that sweetness on the palate. Instead, it becomes this roundness that really works well with the fermented carrot sauce and the sort of the raw fish dish that it's paired with. So that's one wine that's really... really amazing. We have a 1998 Semillon from Yarra Yering from Victoria,
Australia.
I'm in Australia. And that's, you know, a little bit of skin contact there and definitely a mild nutty note that, you know, comes with age for sure, but works well with, you know, the courses that it goes with, you know, like a white kimchi sauce.
Right.
That comes with a steamed crab or like a lacto fermented potato pancake. That we make as well. There's so much fermentation, and you know, I'm kind of playing with those flavors too.
Do you sit with Chef JP? Do you figure out what you think goes well, and do you run it by him? Does he ask you what we're doing? Does he entrust you? I mean, how does that process work?
Yeah, you're totally right. There's a lot of trust that happens here.
That's good.
Especially because...
So he's not micromanaging.
What are we doing? Not necessarily. If anything, he's just kind of curious to taste it too.
A good thing.
Which is
like,
a great thing.
What are we
thing.
Doing here?
Yeah. So we get to R&D when the kitchen is putting together the next menu. You know, I'm there sort of sitting in on that tasting. Just kind of tasting through the ideas. And then when that comes to fruition, which is usually just about a week before we go live with the menu, we taste it again. And then I just bring a smattering of different wines, not necessarily the wine I'm thinking to pair with it, but like a style that I think would work. And then if it does work, you know, branch out from there and then start to nail the actual wine we're going to pour.
Right. Let me ask you this. Before we go into our wine list, which I want to subject you to, your feelings on natural wines.
Yeah,
I mean, not, you know, like Frenchette, the whole wine list is natural. I mean, that's not what you're doing there. But where is natural wine at in your mind and out there?
Yeah, I'd say, well, natural wine definitely is a point in contention in many conversations these days. My stand on it is just, you know, I just want to drink and also serve well-made wine in whichever shape or form that comes in. I think natural wine sometimes can become more of a marketing sort of situation. I think, you know, a lot of wines have been made naturally for hundreds of years. Nobody
Some
was
of
calling
the most
it
famous. Right.
Exactly. Nobody was calling it natural then. And I understand the need today for a bit more visibility. I mean, we are ingesting the liquid that is in the glass. So
as
knowing
people are obsessed with organic foods.
Exactly. I think this definitely comes with the times, and it's a worthy conversation to be had. But, you know, for myself, it's not necessarily something that adds to the conversation for me. I'm not going to like the wine more or less because it's
It's about the wine.
Natural. Yeah.
Natural.
Exactly.
Is important to you, but it's not the total focus.
Yeah. And you also have to think about the capacity to age of these wines as well, and stability when you're shipping. You know, there's a whole other logistical and pragmatic side of things when it comes to this.
That's getting better, and that's being addressed, but that's definitely an issue. Mm-hmm. That's interesting. All right. So I want to subject you to our wine list. We ask all our guests to... answer the wine list. It's 5 questions, same 5 questions to everybody. Don't obsess, don't dwell on them.
Awesome.
Buzz through them. because we want to taste a little of the wine, we may have a few more questions. All right, so the first question is, what are you drinking now? And that's in the context of, what are you enjoying? What are you tasting for the restaurant? What's in your fridge? What's on your table? Is it seasonal? What are you drinking right now? Not the Ciabatta, but what
am I drinking in general right now? Yeah, I'd say I'm drinking a bit of red right now. So
Syrah, Mr. White just went on me.
Just went red.
Okay,
Syrah from the Rhone Valley.
Okay,
it's something I've been enjoying. I've particularly been interested in Côte Rôti.
Okay,
as an appellation.
There's one on your tasting.
There is one.
You're
on
by
tasting.
The glass.
Correct.
Is that something you like?
I do. It's from a Louis Barrul. So it's
spell Barrul for me.
It's a Barrul.
And that's a Côte Rôti.
It's a Côte Rôti, specifically Neve, which is a site in the Côte Brune. It gets a lot of sunlight, old vines. You get a lot of this sort of a black pepper olive tapenade note. Really
the classic.
Floral. Yeah, the classic notes you get, just really nuanced.
Is that seasonal? I mean, it got cold and it feels good to drink that, or you just got steered to that anyway?
Yeah, I'd say I'm always moody when it comes to sort of what's tickling my fancy as far as wine goes. I've been kind of just drinking that.
All right, good one. Do you have, you spent many nights at Attaboy, do you have a favorite wine and food pairing? Do you have something you go back to, something that's, what?
Yeah, I'd say aged Riesling. And at the food at Attaboy, yeah. I say aged Riesling. I remember this.
Aged Riesling and what? The food. Give me something
specific.
That's perfect.
I think it was a sort of a maitake mushroom, sort of soy glazed, like very vegetable focused dish. It was during one of the collaborations that I think worked really well.
So when the wine and the mushrooms, you threw it all down, I was like, whoa.
I was like, oh my gosh. Okay. Yeah.
Good one. All right. You're a pretty busy guy, but you get out and about every now and then. And I don't want you to be inclusive or exclusive, but tell me favorite wine restaurant and or bars. Tell me who's doing a good job out there. Where would you hang out?
Yeah, I don't really get out, Sam.
You don't?
No, I'm just joking.
You got to get out more, man.
Yeah, I know. I really do. When I do get out, I definitely want to shout out Norita.
Okay.
I think they have an awesome, still under the radar wine program run by Jin An. And that's also a place, that's a place where I met Elio Park way back when, and I just enjoyed his work from the get-go. So I'd say that spot for sure.
Anything else?
Yeah, I'd say Racine's, which is Pascaline. I mean, that's definitely a no-brainer.
Yeah.
She's
an entity in herself.
In herself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's fun to be there, be with her.
For sure.
Those are two good ones.
Yeah.
Do you, at this point, have a favorite all-time wine or wines or an experience that involved a wine that, you could single out or a couple instances?
Oh, wow. That's a really hard question.
What comes to mind? I mean, it does. I always say this. It doesn't have to be the rarest, the most expensive.
Yes.
Sometimes it was the experience more than the wine, and the wine was there for the ride.
That's
what
true.
Comes to mind?
Yeah, well, the first thing that really popped in my head was my taste of, it was an older Bordeaux. This was a Chateau Le Pan, 1982. And I think that just kind of, it was
great
the first
vintage year.
Yeah.
That was the Robert Parker vintage.
Yeah. 82. It was the first time I was tasting through sort of as a young Somme. It was just in a sea of the first growths of the 82s, which I was already flabbergasted and blown away by. This wine just kind of stood out, sort of spotlight on it. I was like, what is this?
I mean, it's a great wine and a great vintage year.
Yeah.
So it caught you at the right time.
It really did.
All right, last question. I ask everybody this. You should be able to handle it. Best wine around $15-$20 retail. Give me a red. Give me a white. This is my setup every week. It's boring. My kids are about your age. They're going to a party. They're making a few bucks. They don't want to bring a sucky wine.
Yes.
They don't want to spend $8. They don't want to spend $40. They want to spend $20. They're bringing a red and a white. What's the play?
Yeah. Let's see here.
You can give me region, maker. You could say Muscadet.
Yes. I'd say Ava Fricka, Riesling, Trocken from the Rheingau.
Fricke.
Yes.
Ava Fricka. Riesling, Trocken. And that's $20 or less?
Probably about there.
Okay.
Yeah. So I think that would be a great wine.
And let's start with New York.
The
wine stores you'd expect have it?
Absolutely.
Okay.
I think they would definitely see it.
All right. Give me a red.
Yeah, for the red, let's see here. The red seems to be a little bit harder to find.
Well, you're such a white,
I know,
you know, obsessed guy currently.
Yeah, I would say Jean-Baptiste Suillard from the Northern Rhone. He has this amazing...
Jean-Baptiste, spell the last name.
Suillard is a S-O-U-I-L-L-A-R-D.
Okay, and where was that again?
This is from the Northern Rhone. This is 100% Syrah.
Okay.
And this is, you know, Vin de France. It's not even, you know...
Right.
Yeah, it's not even Côte de Rhône. It's Vin de France from different
parcels.
It's
not even Côte de Rhône.
Yeah.
It's like the level below it.
Exactly. It's okay. A generic French red, but this guy, he's a young winemaker and just...
It's good stuff.
It's really good stuff.
And that's $15-$20?
Yeah, it should be.
All right. So like I said earlier, we're going to post all those because I figured I can get a few good recos out of you. All right, Jonelle, we're going to end this show. We're not ending now, but we're going to end the show soon. With our feature, the Weekly Wine Sip. Every week we taste a different wine on air for our Weekly Wine Sip. I asked Jonelle if he'd be kind and gracious enough to bring in a wine. More important to me, it's, you know, what he has access to and what he selected. So this week we're tasting a 2016 Louis Ciabra Xisto Cru.
Yeah,
Xisto Cru.
Yeah.
And that's from Portugal, which we were talking about, and it's from the Douro Valley. And I think Ciabra was a winemaker with Nieuport.
He was, yeah.
And this is a field blend, right?
This is
a bunch of... All right, so tell me more, even though I said everything.
Yeah.
And so pour me some while we're talking.
Absolutely.
Let's get a buzz on here, will you?
Let's do it. Good. All right. So now that our glasses are filled.
Tell me a little more about this.
So I actually tasted with Louis Ciabra in the Douro Valley when I was visiting then, and he was showing off his first vintages, which I was just really rocked by.
These are his first vintages since he left?
Since he left, yeah.
Really?
Which is, I think 13 may have been the first one.
Oh, really?
Okay. And then 14s were, you know, just about available in the U.S. then. So the grapes here in the Xisto Cru, really, literally translated cru means raw. So this is raw schist. Is the actual name of the wine. And the main grape here is called Rabigatu,
right,
with a little bit of Codiga and Gouveiu blended in. So classic field blend here.
The middle grape. Spell that for me.
Codiga?
Yeah.
It's a C-O-D-E-G-A.
Codiga. Okay.
Yeah, these are grapes that you'll never really find alone or predominantly in a blend. But Rabigatu definitely is. It has this just amazing texture.
Right.
So just... It kind of reminds me of a Chenin Blanc in some ways, just so you can, you know, listeners can have a little bit of something to anchor themselves onto. It's got great acidity.
All right, so let's go through the vitals. Color.
Yeah.
It's got a light pale yellow, right?
Yeah, pale yellow.
Give me the nose.
Yeah.
I'm deferring to you because I know what I smell, but I can't articulate. So what are we smelling here?
Well, off the bat, I'm getting something, you know, very citrus driven.
Yes.
So a lot of citrus here, but not just like plain. There's fresh citrus, but also a bit of a sort of a candied or cooked citrus thing happening here, like a Meyer lemon cake sort
right.
of situation.
A little sweeter than the tart citrus, which is nice.
Yeah, there's a bit of a honeyed note that kind of jumps out of the glass as well.
For sure.
Yeah.
Let's go mouthfeel. It's got a nice full... It's not a thin, it's not a mouth-filling wine.
It is. It's got a lot of texture on the palate. And
A little acidity.
Yeah.
Not crazy, but on the tongue.
Yeah. It's got great, it's a little unctuous on the palate, which is really...
Yeah, medium plus for a white. All right.
Sure.
Do the nose descriptors translate to the palate? Tell me what you get on the palate. Let's throw it over the tongue, swish it around. Tell me what else you get.
Yeah, so I'm getting like this, a little salinity on the palate, which is what I love about Douro Valley whites. They're always almost a little salty because of that. You know,
so subtle. I mean, works so well.
Exactly, and I think it's almost like when you have it with food, just a little sprinkling of that citrus and that salt that just makes everything.
So you get a little citrus, a little salt. Anything else that?
Yeah,
is prominent.
A really awesome earthiness. I think there's a little bit of just sort of a light, sort of earthen, mushroomy note coming out here in the glass, sort of in the background.
It's a delicious wine.
Yeah.
Now, fortunately, it's delicious. Unfortunately, but not unrealistic. It's not cheap.
It's true.
It's about a $50-$60 bottle of wine, but it's a special bottle of wine. I mean, it's, yes, you know, for a nice dinner with nice food, and it's about as good a white as you're going to taste. What foods would we pair this with?
I'd say you can run the gamut here. You can go for something raw, maybe like a base Gallup ceviche. Yeah, you could do that, acid-driven stuff. You could also go for something a little bit meatier, say like a grilled fish in a white sauce, or even a little bit of pasta. Mm. I think would work really
pretty
well.
Pretty versatile.
Here. Yeah, it really is.
So that's the 2016 Louis Ciabra Gisto Cru. Luis was the winemaker at Nearport. He's now out there making his own wines, and leave it to a guy like Jonel to kind of taste it and, you know, put it out there. Is this available at the restaurant?
It is available at the restaurant.
Okay. All right. So, like I said, I'm going to post all that stuff. Jonel, we got to wrap the show up. Things went pretty quickly. I could sit here and talk to you for hours. So that means at some point you're going to have to come back. Jonel's going to be at Riesling Fire this weekend, right?
Yes, I'll be there on Saturday.
One of the serving psalms. Are you there during the day and at night, or just at night?
Just at night, but you can be. I'll be there during the day to taste through as well.
Okay. All right. If you have a question, suggestion, wine happening or event, hit me up at sam@thegrapenation.com. That's sam@thegrapenation.com. Follow us on Facebook at The Grape Nation. Follow us on Instagram at SBenRuby, and you can follow the hashtag The Grape Nation. On Twitter, we're at BenRuby. Also, subscribe to The Grape Nation podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify. We're going to post Jonel's wine list and our weekly wine sip on all our social media sites, so you know what we're talking about. Where can we find you and Atomics on social?
Yeah, so you can find us at AtomixNYC, and you'll find us there and follow
AtomixNYC. And what if people want to get into your shit?
Yeah, come on in. We're right on 30th and Park, and it's right there at that corner in that small residential building. Come visit. You know, the bar is walk-in friendly. Come have a drink.
Okay, and what about your social?
Oh, my social is at Jonel Felinar, so it's J-H-O-N-E-L. F-A-E-L-N-A-R.
Just like you thought.
Yeah.
All right. So I want to thank our guest, Jonel Felinar. Jonel is the head somm at Atomics, one of the more exciting restaurants. He's dealing with a very cool, small, curated wine list, some interesting food, a 3-star restaurant. So congrats and kudos to you. I want to thank our engineer, Noam, and I want to thank everyone at the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Sam BenRuby, and you've been listening to The Grape Nation.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.